Afternoon, Your Honor. So I'm Charles Powers. I'm number bar number 7618, counsel for Mr. and Mrs. Settle. I'd like to start by briefly addressing the issue of negligent supervision, which I think was my first argument. In this case, as you already know, the jury found liability on that there was negligence, but did not find causation. And that could have been because the jury found that the injury was caused in the ATV accident and that there was no causal connection, or it could have been that the jury found that the nurses were responsible and were perhaps an intervening cause, and that the judge had instructed the jury they could not find any liability of the doctor for anything the nurses did, and therefore if there was error in the judge's instruction, we can't know whether there was a link or not, or whether it caused the harm, and therefore I believe it was reversible error. Now, of course, that begs the question whether there should have been a negligent supervision claim or not. And the defense has argued the case of an operating room situation where there are nurses responsible for anesthesia, nurse anesthetists who are trained in that, and a surgeon in another state. I think it's the Vanderbilt case. And you have surgeons doing surgery. That's fundamentally different than an emergency room situation. Even though we're talking about intubation in anesthesia and intubation in an emergency room setting, these are quite different things. In an emergency room, as the evidence in this case showed, the emergency room doctor is primarily responsible for emergency treatment, which includes, number one, the airway, and number one procedure under the airway is intubation. The emergency room doctor, this is one of his or her primary obligations to the patient. This is what she has to be able to do, that she has on her application to the hospital, that she's trained and knows how to do, and she's ready to do it on an emergency basis to establish an airway in an injured patient. And so when, in this particular case, Dr. Basinger decided not to do intubation initially, and then 3 hours later, when it was very clear the patient needed it at that point and was actually in extremis at that point, it was her obligation to do that on an emergency basis, and she chose to delegate that to these nurses while she did something else. So it wasn't as if this is a separate discipline. This is her obligation. She gave this order to the nurses, you do that. Even if she says it was a joint decision or whatever, she's in charge. She decided to let the nurses do that function. And this is occurring in a space that's smaller than this little dais that I'm standing in front of. She's at the head of the fourth to fifth intercostal space, standing at Mr. Settle's side, and they're standing right here. They're here and here. And she's observing what she's doing and cannot help but know what they're doing.
Are you making that argument in support of your negligent supervision claim?
Yes.
or in support of invoking the so-called captain of the ship doctrine?
I'm making that argument on negligent supervision. I'm saying as a captain of the ship is somewhat more esoteric legal principle, and I will get to that, but negligent supervision couldn't be any clearer in this case. She's right there, and they're doing a primary obligation of her that she has delegated to them, and there's very obvious signs it's not going well.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
All right, so let me understand. With the negligent supervision claim, she would have to have a duty, and having a duty is a question of law. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
All right. And so what a court would look at to determine whether there is a duty for negligent supervision includes that, in this case, it would be the doctor would have to have already had reason to believe that either prior conduct or character of these nurses would have created an undue risk of harm. Am I correct on that?
No, not at all. There is a kind of negligent supervision case, a very typical kind of situation. It comes up when someone hires a driver and doesn't look at their driving record and puts them out on the road, and they negligently failed to check in advance. That doesn't, and that's what that kind of line of reasoning is addressing. That happens, and a person has a criminal record, and they send them into the home to do home repairs, and they attack somebody or something like that, a negligent. But that's not the issue here. That doesn't eliminate negligent supervision when the supervisor who delegated the job is standing right there watching the mess up in front of them. Hey, stop that. Let me do that. Move aside. Let me show you how that's supposed to be done. Let me take over. You're being too rough. You haven't medicated the patient adequately. That's negligent supervision. The cases that they want to rely on, because it happens to come up in that situation as well, that's a much more tenuous kind of negligent supervision case. Although in negligent supervision, it doesn't as frequently come up as you see right here in the very obvious, straightforward situation with a servant standing right in front of her.
Let me pursue.
And that's what I'm saying is going on here. And she is appreciating, she is realizing that the servant isn't doing the job and that there's a risk of harm because she's seeing it happen right there in front of her. That's my point. Yes, sir.
Okay. But the, Dr. Basinger and the AirLife nurses were strangers up until 2 or 3 hours ago.
Right.
Don't most of the negligent supervision cases involve a pre-existing relationship, usually one of employer-employee, as opposed to people who are otherwise strangers?
Would typically, but not required. In this case, these nurses are licensed nurses. She knows that. She knows they're from an institution, and she knows that they have licenses to be nurses. She's a physician with a license to be a physician. They walk into her emergency room to take over or to move this patient up to Denver, and there's a period that they're in the emergency room now treating the patient under her command. And that is, even though there's no employer-employee, in the context of medicine, when you have licensed professionals, they deal with each other in a certain way. And the doctor in the ER, even though there's somebody else's nurse, they were there to transfer the patient, and she delegated, and they took that particular task. But it didn't mean that without the employer-employee relationship, that there's not a known duty of responsibility of doctor and nurse handling a case in her emergency room under her zone of control. Now, the doctors, that's not a purely legal analysis. You have to look to the facts and you have to look to the medical opinions and to know the relative responsibilities and the law, the statutes, of course, as well. And the doctors were very clear, even her, that, in the emergency room, she's in charge of the nurses, even somebody else's nurse. When she's given an order to a nurse and the nurse is carrying it out, she's in charge there under her command.
If it was an emergency situation where an ambulance driver and attendant rolled somebody in on a cart, and she would be responsible for what they did in the ER under a negligent supervision
theory? Absolutely. The moment they're in there, not until she's on the case.
Yeah, no, I understand.
The moment they're in there, that's the relationship. They're carrying out their responsibilities. They walk in. They actually take commands in the field. But once they're in the ED and she's now making commands, absolutely, if they're not doing what she's directing, there would be chaos if that wasn't the case. I mean, who would, nurses just don't have licenses, just go off and practice medicine, and the doctors would say, I'm not in charge of this patient. I can't.
Mr. Powers.
Yes, sir.
Then, given your description, how would that be different from captain of the ship? I mean, it sounds to me like you are, in effect, arguing captain of the ship.
I agree that there's probably a captain of the ship argument. The distinction, I think, with negligent supervision is that in captain of the ship, they might do something out of her awareness that she might be responsible for because it's vicarious liability. In other words, she or he, whoever it happens to be, is legally responsible for the carrying out of that order, even though they didn't see the carrying out of that order. So it's a matter of law that she is in command, and even though she didn't directly see this error, she's responsible for that error. Negligent supervision, and as I see it, is a very active thing, in the fact that not only is she in command, but she is in the presence and knew or should have known of the conduct occurring, and was directly aware and didn't alter, affect, or intervene the course of what was happening.
Dr. Bassinger had actual or constructive knowledge that the AirLife nurses were mishandling the intubation?
I had the opinions of the doctors, but yes, I felt the facts were self-evident, that she was immediately present, and that the facts were that they were intubating with inadequate medication, and they made four attempts that didn't function while she was standing there. I mean, weren't effective. The one doctor said that those attempts were negligent, and the other doctor said she negligently oversaw that operation.
Mr. Powers says negligent supervision normally involves an employer-employee relationship, does it not?
Yes.
And so are you aware of any case that separates that out, apart from captain of the ship, that separates that out and says, given no employer-employee relationship, given no prior knowledge, that this doctor, for example, would have the responsibility for supervising in some other way than she did?
I believe the statute is very clear that nurses have to be acting under the supervision of a physician, and I think that that's overriding any case law on the subject, but I think that the captain of the ship cases that you've looked at acknowledge that doctors can have responsibility for what nurses do, although in that case I think it's a logical extension farther beyond a direct physical presence like we have here in this case. It's more remote. So I think this is less extenuating than the captain of the ship situation. This is an immediate situation in a very small proximate area where all this is taking place.
There's a distinction. The elements include that the employer has some kind of awareness that the employee poses a risk, as opposed to the employees engaged in conduct that
yes.
poses a risk. Would this be an extension of law to say there's no indication that these nurses posed a risk, but of course the activity that they were involved in always imposes a risk?
I think that the one situation is a subtext of the as a subcategory of the other. In other words, we weren't saying that they were facially incompetent or that she should have known in advance they were incompetent. We're saying that when events began to evolve in front of her, she then knew. Whether they were incompetent or not is not the issue. Things weren't going properly and she needed to intervene. We're not saying, they didn't have the credentials. Just because they didn't have the credentials doesn't mean they weren't making a mistake at a particular time or that it wasn't occurring in front of her. Whether they're not capable of a mistake, or they're not capable of just not being able to handle it adequately because it was maybe over their head and she didn't realize it until she saw it happening.
Thank you.
Statement test of this court is cast in terms of liability for a servant or an agent. Were these nurses one or both, and if so, which one and why?
They became, in my opinion, and I would think that they became servants of her the moment she decided to delegate to them a medical procedure that was her responsibility in her emergency department, and they decided to accept that. Now, they're not just volunteers. They are working for a company, and those companies are interrelated. Hospitals and emergency departments are interrelated with ambulance services that are separate companies, but they...
I'm not suggesting that there's any connection between Dr. Basinger's hospital and Swedish Hospital in this air ambulance?
None other than the fact that they refer patients all the time, and this is a kind of a run they make all the time. They do business with each other all the time. This hospital calls Swedish all the time, and they come down to pick up patients, and so that's what they do. That's the business they're in, and Rio Grande is one of the hospitals that sends a lot of patients to them and calls them a lot of time to come down and pick them up. It might be like a contractor uses a plumbing firm a lot. They're not working for him, but when they come on the job and he sees they're putting the plumbing in wrong, he says, you know, that's not right.
Time's exhausted.
Thank you.
Appreciate your response to our questions.
Right. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Alan Epstein representing Dr. Basinger and Rio Grande Hospital. With me at council table is Jesse Pellant. Please excuse the primitive technology. Plaintiff's first two arguments in the opening brief were that the trial court erred in entering summary judgment on plaintiff's captain of the ship claim and negligent supervision claim. If this was error, it was necessarily harmless, but assuming it was not harmless, plaintiff's claims failed on their merits. The jury found that Dr. Basinger was negligent, but that her negligence did not cause plaintiff's tracheal tears. Plaintiff's causation theory was that Dr. Basinger misplaced the first chest tube and should have intubated plaintiff within the first 30 minutes of arrival. Had she done so, plaintiff contended, Dr. Basinger would not have had to place the second chest tube while the flight nurses intubated him. Plaintiff's theory was that the tears were caused by rough intubation. Defendant introduced evidence that, in fact, the tears did not occur during intubation, but during the rollover accident, the ATV rollover accident. Therefore, under the parties' theories of the case and the evidence introduced at trial, the only way the jury could have found negligence but no causation was if defendant negligently placed the first chest tube and failed to intubate sooner, but that this negligence did not cause plaintiff's tears because they were caused in the accident. And if they were caused in the accident, then the flight nurses did not cause them. If the flight nurses did not cause them, dismissal of these claims was necessarily harmless error.
Once those claims are dismissed, once summary judgment is entered, the plaintiff can't go forward with that theory. They can't try that theory any longer. The captain of the ship, or the negligent supervision. So, how can we take a case that was tried on a different issue, take conclusions from the jury verdict, and then say, therefore, necessarily, the summary judgment was harmless?
Because if the trier of fact determined that the nurses did not cause the tears, then it would have been futile to present the captain of the ship claim or the negligent supervision claim, because they necessarily hinged on the factual assumption that the tears were caused by the nurses.
If summary judgment had not been entered, then the jury would have the evidence would have presented some evidence of negligent supervision, and the court would have instructed the jury, and the jury might have come back and said, you know, the nurses did cause it, and it's your fault.
The jury would have been presented with the identical causation evidence at trial. The fact, the elements of those claims, the captain of the ship and negligent supervision claims, go to liability, go to negligence or vicarious liability, not causation. So the necessary result of the jury's determination of no causation would have rendered the captain of the ship and negligent supervision claims moot, if you will, because they depended on the nurses causing the tears.
Mr. Epstein.
And you're saying the jury verdict unequivocally is that the accident caused the tears and the nurses did not.
Yes, based on the evidence and the parties' theories of the case, the jury must have found that the tears were caused in the accident, not by the intubation, because plaintiff's theory of the case was that the nurses caused the tears. The theory of negligence against Dr. Basinger was that she misplaced the first chest tube and should have intubated sooner. So the jury's finding that she was negligent must have meant that that's how she was negligent. The jury's finding of no causation must have meant that negligence didn't cause the tears because the rollover accident did. That's why it's harmless error in retrospect, but it's still harmless error.
Mr. Epstein, just let me ask you then to respond to Mr. Powers suggested that the jury could have found that the nurses were an intervening cause, and therefore it would not have been harmless error.
They could only have been an intervening cause if they caused the tracheal tears. The jury couldn't have found that because the theory of negligence against Dr. Basinger was that, again, she misplaced the first chest tube and should have intubated sooner. The nurses could have only been an intervening cause if they in fact did cause the tracheal tears, but the jury's findings necessarily implied that they didn't. I'd also note that in plaintiff's argument regarding Dr. Warner's deposition, they note on page 23 of their reply brief that the jury found that plaintiff was injured in the ATV accident, not during intubation, based in part on Dr. Warner's testimony. So plaintiffs concede that the jury's no causation finding necessarily implied that plaintiff's injuries were caused in the ATV accident. Assuming that summary judgment on plaintiffs, I'll turn first to the captain of the ship claim, was not harmless error. The captain of the ship doctrine has been confined in Colorado to situations in which the plaintiff was injured during surgery by a hospital employee. Plaintiff was not injured during surgery. Dr. Basinger was not a surgeon, and the flight nurses were not hospital employees. And in any event, Dr. Basinger did not exercise the supervision and control over the flight nurses necessary to hold her vicariously liable for the flight nurses' acts. Supporting defendant summary judgment motion was the deposition of the chief flight nurse for AirLife, who testified that the nurses had to follow the AirLife crash airway algorithm, and they would only follow a physician's direction if that direction was congruent with those protocols.
Is your point that the summary judgment record essentially precludes the negligent supervision claim because the nurses were going to follow their own protocol regardless?
No, what I'm saying is that the necessary, I'm talking about the captain of the ship claim now, the degree of control over Dr. Basinger's degree of control over the nurses was insufficient to impose captain of the ship liability because they were intubating him while she placed a second chest tube, and they were intubating pursuant to these protocols.
How does your argument, my question, relate more directly to the negligent supervision claim?
Well, the negligent supervision claim in Colorado, the tort of negligent supervision is based on several restatement of tort and agency, I believe, sections, and the test enunciated by the Supreme Court in Raleigh v. Performance Plumbing and Koja v. Keller is that what your honors were implying in argument earlier. under this tort, a plaintiff must establish that an employer's employee posed an unreasonable risk of harm to third parties, and the employer knew or should have known that the employee could cause harm. In this case, the flight nurses were not Dr. Basinger's employees. Plaintiffs introduced no evidence that they posed a risk of harm to anyone or that she even knew who they were.
Let's assume, given the deference we have to give to the non-moving party for summary judgment, let's assume the summary judgment record is, as your adversary characterized it, that Dr. Basinger specifically delegates to these nurses the intubation procedure and is in sufficient proximity to that going on that she knew or should have known it wasn't going well. And I'm not asking you to concede that globally, but let's assume that's in the summary judgment record. Why wouldn't there be some cause of action based on principles of negligence respondeat superior on the patient's behalf back against Dr. Basinger?
Because absent a negligent supervision claim, there is no other cause of action that fits. And this was not a negligent supervision claim. None of the elements are met.
Well, then who's responsible for what the nurses, let's assume what the nurses did was negligent. The who's responsible?
Are. The nurses are.
And no one.
And they were defendants in this case.
Yeah. And no one above them?
No.
Okay.
Well, whoever employed them.
Yeah.
Arguably, if they were, if their employer had knowledge that they were posed a risk of harm to third parties, which they didn't because they were very skilled nurses. But if anybody was liable for what they did, if what they did caused the injuries, they are. And they, in fact, were parties who settled. Counsel did not reach the discretionary rulings that also are a basis of plaintiff's appeal, and I think I've covered those issues in our answer brief, and I just reiterate that all of these issues were discretionary decisions. The determination to limit plaintiff's cross-examination of Dr. Basinger regarding her past medical record and past medical history struck an appropriate balance. The court ruled that plaintiff could inquire on the limitations on her Colorado license, but ruled that further inquiry on these topics was inappropriate because what happened was temporarily remote or inadmissible under Rule 403. Similarly, the trial court appropriately limited the plaintiff's cross-examination or impeachment of defendant's expert, Dr. Nelson. The court also struck a proper balance in imparting some information, but keeping details of her past that really weren't relevant to her medical expertise from the jury.
But let me ask one question that I think cuts across several of those issues. Did Dr. Basinger opine on the causation of Mr. Settle's injuries, i.e. between the intubation and the ATV accident, or did she only, as an expert, did she only testify as to what she thought the standard of care was and whether she complied with it?
My recollection is that she did opine on causation.
As between the
I'm not recollecting exactly what she said, except I do have a recollection of her saying that the nurses were skilled, appeared to be skilled, and knew what they were doing, and weren't doing anything that could have resulted in these injuries. But it was Dr. Nelson's testimony that was more specific with respect to the reason that the configuration of the conda tube or the intubation tube could not have caused these injuries. Instead, the injuries were more consistent with an ATV rollover accident, the impact of the accident.
Mr. Epstein, I'm not sure I'm understanding your harmless error argument, and I want to see if I can't get closer to understanding it. So I'm going to tell you what I'm hearing, and then you tell me where I'm wrong. The way that this case was tried was that the plaintiff's theory was that the patient should have been intubated sooner, and that the jury found that the doctor was negligent, and apparently that would be on the basis that the doctor should have intubated sooner. Am I tracking so far?
Yes.
And so they did find that Dr. Basinger should have intubated sooner, but then they find that there was no causation of the ultimate injuries. And you're saying that necessarily that means that it occurred in the ATV accident, and necessarily it did not occur in the course of the intubation by the other nurses?
Yes.
And tell me again why it is, that last part, that it is necessarily so?
Because there's no other explanation for the jury's findings, given the theories, parties' theories of the case and the evidence introduced. The plaintiffs introduced evidence, the theory of negligence was Dr. Basinger should have intubated sooner, she should have, and then the nurses would not have performed a rough intubation. That's the only theory of negligence. If the jury found negligence, intubation, or a failure to place the chest tube and should have intubated sooner, then in order to find liability, they would have had to have found that the nurses caused the tracheal tears. The finding of no causation necessarily can only imply that the ATV rollover accident caused it, because there's no other explanation under the evidence.
It could not have implied that the failure to intubate sooner caused no injury.
The failure to intubate sooner
caused no injury.
It did not. It did cause any. No, it didn't cause any injury. It set up the circumstance that there had to be a later intubation, and it was the later intubation that caused the injury.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.